Universe.
Yes, thank you very much, Matthias, Piero, and Andrea. I don't see you, unfortunately, but I've seen numbers. And thank you for the invitation, and it's really a great pleasure to be here. I came a little bit early this morning, so I had time to walk along the beach, and I would love to stay longer. when we planned this, I didn't realize, I mean, this is the first brunch or breakfast seminar that I gave, and probably it's the first ever. And when we planned it, it was not, the Leibniz Prize was not yet known. So when I got the Leibniz Prize, I said to Matthias, oh, then we could have a champagne, but I didn't really mean it. But then he had champagne for this morning, so thank you very much. This is really starting us off very nicely. So I want to talk about the growth of black holes in the universe. Just coming back from the Texas Symposium, it became clear, which I have advertised since many years, that the black holes have a much strong, much more important role in galaxy formation and evolution than people may have thought previously. And in the end, I will try to convince you that maybe the black holes have been there first, and then the galaxies came later. And so this fits quite nicely, I think, into the theme of the workshop, galaxy and intergalactic medium interaction, because the black hole has a very strong role also how the intergalactic medium is behaving. I will mainly talk about two deep fields, but I will also talk about, I mean, as large a scope as possible for X-ray surveys. But these deep fields are the ones which, together with the one in the Hubble Deep Field North, which is led by Amy Barger, Neil Brandt, and others, are really pushing and drilling the deepest holes in the X-ray universe. And then the luminosity function, which is very important to understand the overall picture, I'm doing together with Martin Schmidt at Caltech and Takamitsu Miyagi. Let me start up with an introduction about the X-ray background. The X-ray background was discovered in 62 by the rocket flights that Jaconi did. And Jaconi was originally aiming at the moon. He wanted to see a reflection or fluorescent emission from the moon. The moon in this graph is here. But what he found when the rocket was scanning over the sky was a huge signal, which we know is the brightest X-ray source in the sky, SCOEX-1. It's this one here. And then he also found this continuous emission over the whole sky, which is then became known as the X-ray background. So the moon was not a source at that time. 28 years later, one of the first images that ROSAT took, we were actually observing the moon and we saw the fluorescent emission from the bright side of the moon. But for us, more important was that the dark side of the moon is actually casting a shadow on the background, and that shows first that the background is beyond the moon, but more but more importantly that our detectors are so good on ROSAT, we're so good that we can really study the background very well because our intrinsic signal is so much lower. There's actually something interesting with these few photons which are on the backside of the moon, because they are much more than our intrinsic background. If we switch, if we close the filter, then the thing is completely black. So there is actually real emission coming from that dark side, and that caused a lot of head scratching. At that time, we thought that these are solar wind particles which are impinging on the moon and are reflecting. But now we believe that the whole Earth is, we have seen X-ray emission from comets. And the comet's emission is actually interaction of the solar wind with the neutral atmosphere around the comet. And the Earth is also surrounded by such an atmosphere. And so we are sometimes looking like a comet cloud. And so this stuff is really background, which is in front of the moon. So it's not really, it has some meaning. Okay, so the ROSAT All-Sky Survey map then beautifully showed that most of the background is actually in this softband galactic, of galactic origin, hot supernova remnant bubbles. This is a supernova remnant which is sitting right in front of our nose. And this red stuff is largely hot gas emission of a supernova remnant in which the sun is sitting. So it's the so-called local bubble. And only at the high galactic latitudes, we are actually clean from the galactic emission. So when we do our studies, we are looking in areas where there is a clean line of sight. And one of the best areas in the sky is the Lockman hole. The Lockman hole is the lowest neutral hydrogen interstellar medium hole. And so we have spent with ROSAT already about a month of observing time looking into the Lockman hole. And we coined for the first time here, I think, the term megasecond observation. megasecond observations are quite standard in this game. And we indeed were able to resolve about 75 to 80% of this diffuse emission into individual discrete sources. So that's the same that Galileo did when he looked through his telescope at the Milky Way and found out it's not made of milk but of stars. And the same thing we did with the X-rays. Then with the new X-ray telescopes, XMM Newton and Chandra, we went much deeper. This is the same field here, the Lockman hole observed with XMM Newton, and you see it has about 10 times more sources than ROSAT. This is partly due to the fact that we go much deeper, but also partly that we can observe at higher energies where ROSAT is already blinded, and we can actually look through much more obscuring material. And so with these measurements, we now have resolved almost 100% of the soft background. But as I will show, we still have a long way to go to resolve all of the X-ray background. And this is when you look at the... Oh, just for... The punchline of the talk is that this background that we see is basically the echo of the black hole formation in the universe. So all of the black holes which we see in nearby galaxies had to have grown at some time, and they have deposited light in the background, and this is what we see in the overall background emission. The X-ray background spectrum, oops, Okay, the X-ray background spectrum has long been known to be peaking at 30 keV, mainly from the old TO1 data, which is already more than 30 years old. But there was, from the very beginning, there was a big, not a big, but a 30% uncertainty, a discrepancy between different measurements. And this 30% uncertainty is still maintained until modern times. So the modern measurements of the background in this classical X-ray range are about 30% higher than the HIO1 background, which was always taken as a kind of sacred thing. In the meantime, the RXTE SLU survey also indicates that the background is 30% higher even at the peak. And so people are now starting to believe that HIO1 actually had a 30% error in its response matrix. And that indeed the background is 30% higher than what HIO1 told us. And this is bad news because it means that all of the resolved fractions have to be corrected down. So while people believed they had resolved the background with Chandra and XMM, it is now no longer the case. Chandra and XMM only resolved about 50% of the background, which is a bit awkward. Jaconi has planned Chandra to resolve the background, and indeed now ROSAT has resolved its background, but Chandra has not yet resolved the background. So there is still a lot about 50% or so has been resolved in this high energy part. There's still a lot left for a next generation of X-ray telescopes which can observe at even higher energies. But I believe that no mysteries are expecting us. I mean, our models, when we take what we know and fold this through all the cosmological evolution and so on, they can easily account for this flux. But it's just in terms of the measurement, it's unfortunately not yet completed. Einstein and ROSAT have pioneered this field, but in the meantime, it has flared out into a kind of industry. So there are many groups worldwide who do X-ray surveys with many different instruments. And what is shown here is just a collection of some of the most recent surveys where I'm plotting the solid angle on the sky versus the limiting flux in the soft and in the hard band. So the whole sky is the limit here. And there is the HIO1 all-sky survey in the hard band and the ROSAT all-sky survey that have covered this. And then when you go deeper, finally you end up with the deepest Chandra pointings, which are only covering about 0.2, 0.1 square degree, but they are 5 orders of magnitude fainter. So indeed you have, when you study cosmological evolution, on one hand you have to know what is out there, but you also have to compare that to the local universe in order to get the lever arm. And so when you want to study evolution, you really have to take into account all of these surveys, and as I will show in the end. We are trying to push this field further, and these green circles are all the ongoing and planned surveys, or maybe even new missions that are proposed, to basically dig in deeper. We want to go both deeper and also wider. So the message is that we need to cover larger areas, but at a larger depth. So I will show you in the end some ongoing work, which is now the frontier, the cosmos field, and the extended Chandra Deep Field South. And finally, what we are all hoping for is in the next decade, a new big X-ray mission, Constellation X and XUS together probably, which will then finally get the deepest observations here. These are the currently deepest surveys in the X-rays. This is both the Chandra Deep Field North and Chandra Deep Field South. This is from a review for Astronomy and Astrophysics that Neil Brandt and myself have written, so joining the forces of the two teams that are pushing deepest. And this is the Hubble Deep Field proper, and this is the Chandra Ultra Deep Field in the southern field proper. And so in each of these fields you have about 20 or so, 25, 20 X-ray sources. And I will just show you, this is the deepest optical field around, the ultra deep field, and these are the X-ray sources. Just show you a few family portraits of how X-ray sources, faint X-ray sources, look like in the optical. This is a set of type 1 AGN. So type 1 is those which are unabsorbed, where we can look at the black hole directly without a lot of gas and dust in the center. Some of them are classical quasars, so they look like point-like sources. This is, for instance, at the redshift 3.2. Down here, there's an object at the redshift 3.06 and so on. So not all of them are really bright point-like sources. This here, we only see a galaxy, and here we see a kind of interacting group, and even Chandra cannot quite tell us where the AGN is sitting that we are seeing. And this is another galaxy. Sometimes these objects in the literature are called X-bongs. That means X-ray bright optical normal galaxies. They have properties like X-ray quasars, but when you look in the optical, they are bright optical galaxies and they don't look anything like a normal quasar. And I think the reason for that, one of the reasons, is that the galaxy is outshining the point source in the center. So these are sources which are intrinsically unabsorbed, so they have no right to be hidden, but we still don't see them. And I think one of the reasons is that the galaxy is so bright that it is outshining the...
Are all these Chandra?
Yes, these are all Chandra sources, yes. Then I have a set of sources which we call optically faint AGN. They are extremely faint, so for instance here, again, it's probably this guy here, it's this guy here, it is probably this guy here, which is doing the X-ray emission. And they are so faint, fainter than 25th magnitude, that we cannot get their spectra. We cannot determine their redshift and so on from spectroscopy. And we have to apply to photometric redshift techniques. And these photometric redshifts give us 1.6, 1.8, 1.5. Here this one is at 4.3 redshift. So these are also type 1 or type 2 AGN, but they are so distant that the optical light in the galaxy is just not sufficient to tell us for the redshift. And this is an interesting kind of pre-galactic or something like that murk, where somewhere in here is the Chandra AGN. And then, yes?
What is the X-ray flux limit relative to the Hubble flux limit? In other words, are you seeing all the real X-ray sources there?
Normal quasars have an X-ray to optical flux limit of 1, roughly. And in that limit, we are actually, the X-ray flux is going deeper than the Chandra limit. But then when you have absorbed quasars, then their optical flux is reduced, so they don't show up in the optical. And then you only see the galaxy, the stars from the galaxy in the optical light. So it's a bit hard to say. I think for normal quasars, Chandra is actually going somewhat deeper than Hubble. So we have objects which have no Hubble counterpart, but we still believe that they are normal quasars. And finally, when we go even fainter, to the faintest X-ray limits, then we start to see bright star-forming galaxies, relatively nearby objects, redshift 0.5 or so. So there we don't see the X-ray source itself, the point source, but we see hot gas, which is heated up by supernova remnants, or maybe already we start to see intergalactic medium in groups that are surrounding these galaxies. So I think the message is that the optical identification of these X-ray sources is a real problem. It's a bottleneck because we are pushing deepest in one energy band, and then we want to pick up those sources in the other energy band where they may be even fainter than the faintest optical surveys. So we have to resort both to spectroscopy on very large telescopes. This is done on the Keck and on the VLT, but then spectroscopy is running out roughly at 25th magnitude, and we have many objects that go out to 28th magnitude in optical limits. And so for this, the goods area and the GEMS and the Hubble ultra deep field photometry is extremely important to get photometric redshifts. And for this field here in the Chandra Deep Field South, this is now the best field in terms of photometric redshifts because it has been covered with VLT near-infrared imaging to an incredible depth, to a depth of k equals 24 or so. So 30 nights of VLT infrared, near-infrared imaging has gone into this field. And so this is not achieved anywhere else on the sky. And therefore, we have quite good photometric redshifts. And we are getting more than 95% of the X-ray sources. We now have some information about where they lie. And interesting, these hatched regions are the spectroscopic information in redshift which we have, and the open histogram is the photometric redshifts. And you see that the photometric redshifts are filling in this difficult region of redshift 1 to 2, what is called the redshift desert. But in general, the spectroscopic redshifts already have told us that there's a peak in redshift at redshift 0.7, and if you include the photometric redshifts, this peak is still very pronounced. And so this is the real news that nobody has thought before. When you look at a sample of X-ray sources, we thought that they behave like quasars, and quasars we know have their redshift maximum at a redshift of 2 or so. And this was the immediate surprise that the redshift maximum of these X-ray sources is actually more like 0.7 at much lower redshifts than anticipated before. Okay.
Are you saying yes? That most of those sources are not quasars, or that they are? They're only that X-ray bright quasars are not the same as optically bright quasars.
Okay, I forgot to go a little bit more into detail here. So we have two types of sources. We discriminate between type 1 and type 2, whether the X-ray emission is absorbed or unabsorbed. And this is pretty much relating to whether you see broad lines in the optical or narrow lines. Also, this is not always a one-to-one relation. In particular, we have X-ray sources which we call type 1 AGN, and they have not a single emission line. There we see the stars in the galaxy, and the stars give us the redshift, but we still know from the X-rays the luminosity and that it is unabsorbed. So we are calling this a type 1 AGN. And this class of sources would be completely absent in the optical samples because the optical samples are selecting according to emission lines or UV excess and so on. And the problem is when you take the classical Seyfert sample, the objects that Seyfert has discovered, like for instance NGC 1068, which is a famous Seyfert galaxy, Ed Moran and others have looked at this Seyfert galaxy in the integrated light. They have taken spectra of the whole galaxy, and when you do that, then the Seyfert lines are not showing up anymore. So local Seyferts you can study well because you can put the slit exactly on the nucleus, but these objects are at redshifts 1 and 2, and they are only a few arc seconds across, and therefore we are seeing the whole light of the galaxy. So this is the main difference between X-ray and optical selection. In the X-rays, the stellar dilution is much smaller because stars are much weaker X-ray sources than compared to the AGN. And so in the X-rays, we can actually push almost a factor of 1,000 deeper in the luminosity of the AGN. Something similar to what Louis Ho is doing when he looks at nearby galaxies, even normal galaxies, and he puts a very narrow slit over the nucleus, he still sees AGN, which have not been known. So the X-rays are a very efficient means to sample the black hole, which the optical is breaking down at low luminosities. Okay, now an important point is there has been a lot of discussion We know CFAT1s and CFAT2s. CFAT2s are the obscured variety of the CFAT1s, but there has been a 10-year-long debate whether there are quasar-2s. So objects which are heavily, which are highly luminous, but still heavily obscured. And there was, from the optical means, I think there was a big debate in the literature whether this is existing. In the meantime, we have found type 2 quasars. So we are calling them, when we look at the intrinsic X-ray luminosity, objects that have luminosities above 44 or so, 10 to the 44, we call quasars, because this is roughly where the optical quasar definition. I mean, the optical quasar definition is a kind of working definition that Martin Schmidt has done. He says, I call a quasar an object which is brighter than any galaxy that I know. So galaxies can have optical luminosities in this range. And so they were studying quasars only in this domain. And so what we find now, the CFAT galaxies, this is the ratio between the type 2 and the type 1 sources. So the local CFAT galaxies from as selected from the optical have a ratio roughly 4 to 1, and the X-ray samples find the same ratio. So there are 4 times more absorbed objects in the CFAT range than unabsorbed. But when you go to the type 2 quasars, to the high luminosity objects, we have found them, but their ratio, their fraction of the total population is only 30% or so. So it's 1 out of 3. Whereas here it's 4 out of 5, and so there is that seems to be a real physical trend, that there are much fewer highly absorbed, highly luminous objects than low luminosity objects, and that may be some kind of physical mechanism. So, for instance, the quasar is so luminous that it is able to clean out its environment, the dust is spallated, and things like that. This has not been known before. And that has to be put into the models that we do for the X-ray background. And this is a very important ingredient.
Can it be a redshift thing? I guess the brighter ones probably the mean redshift.
That's true. The brighter ones have a higher redshift. But this goes in the wrong direction. Because if they are at high redshift and they are absorbed, then their continuum is shifted into the soft band, so they are easier to observe. So obscured sources are easier to be seen at high redshifts, but still we find fewer. So, and this is actually only a sample selected in the 2 to 10 keV band. So the high redshift samples, the high redshift objects, we are sampling in the 5 to 30 keV band or so. So absorption shouldn't play a role there. Okay, now let me come to another interesting thing. Chandra clearly has the best point spread function and is most sensitive, so it's pushing deepest into this domain. XMM Newton is kind of complementary to Chandra. It has a larger telescope. It's about 10 times more or 8 times more photons, but it doesn't have such a good point spread function, so you do not collect the photons in such a small circle. Nevertheless, XMM Newton is very good when you look at spectra of the brighter sources. So this is the reason why, for instance, this image is so colorful. You can really look at the color of an X-ray source and roughly say whether it's a soft source that has only photons below 2 keV, or a blue source is a hard source that has only photons above 2 keV. And some sources like this one, for instance, is violet, that has a double Hund spectrum, which has soft and hard photons, but no green photons in between. So you can use this photon collecting power to say something very important about the spectra of these sources. And what we also have is, again, with the Keck telescope, we have the redshifts of most of these sources, 105 or 110 redshifts. And what my student Alina Streblianskaya has done is to add the X-ray spectra of all these sources, but not in the observed frame, but in the rest frame. So she has shifted the spectra to the rest frame. And what is shown here is the average rest frame spectrum of type 1 and type 2 AGN. This is missing here. That those are the type 2, those are the type 1. And what we find is a very strong relativistic iron line in the spectrum of these quasars. This has been seen in individual sources locally, but it has Chandra and XMM Newton observations were kind of varied whether it is there or not, and whether at least it was not there in all sources. What we see here is that the average black hole in the X-ray background is actually accreting very close to the Schwarzschild radius. And then when you do this, you have matter which is swirling around in the accretion disk with the speed of almost the speed of light. And if the matter is approaching you, you are getting a blue-shifted component in the iron emission line. If it is moving away from you, you get a red-shifted component. And overall, everything is redshifted by the gravitational redshift. And so you are getting this characteristic profile, which is steeply increasing on the blue side, and then it goes down very far into the red side. And it's going down further if you have a Kerr black hole, where the inner radius is much closer to the black hole than if you have a Schwarzschild black hole. And therefore, from the shape of this iron line, you can say, because it's going down to roughly 4 to 3 kV, that there is some that there must be some spin involved in these sources. So the average AGN in the background contains a strong relativistic iron line, and it is at least consistent with being spinning.
What is the gravitational redshift? How much is it?
When we do a Lauer fit, I can only tell you what the inner disk inner radius is. It's about 3 Schwarzschild radii. So a maximally spinning black hole would go down to 1.5 Schwarzschild radii, and a Schwarzschild black hole would stop at 6 gravitational radii. And so we see something which is closer in than the Schwarzschild black hole. But the statistics is not yet very good. I mean, it's fantastic to see this signal, but I think we need to continue to work on that to get a better result.
So this is iron 26?
No, this is neutral iron.
Neutral?
At least the models are from neutral iron. I mean, the idea is you have an accretion disk. The accretion disk is relatively cold. I mean, 100,000 degrees or something like that. And
that's hot enough not to have neutral iron.
Yeah, but if you have iron 2 or 3 or 4 or 7, but it still doesn't really change the line so much. I mean, if you have 25, then it changes from 6.4 to 6.7 kV.
No, but you're depending upon using the modeling of the shift to tell you have a Kerr black hole instead of a...
Not really. I think if you can also fit this to ionized iron lines, then the whole thing is shifting further. It would then only make the... The slope would be here. I mean, the difference between ionized and not ionized is only 6.4 to 6.7 or something like that. Whereas we see here, we see 4 out to 6. So this is a 30% shift, whereas all the ionization wouldn't make such a big difference.
I assume that to be that close to an effect, to be called a relativistic effect, the orbital velocity has to be close to the speed of light.
Half of the speed of light, roughly, yes. Yes. I mean, we are seeing Doppler shifts, which are roughly 50% of the emission. So this is, I mean, V delta lambda over lambda is 0.5, and so that's also corresponding to V over C. So it is relativistic, but whether it's really Kerr or Schwarzschild, and actually what we have to say, all these models are assuming a disk inclination, and we have many objects, and we have a kind of average ensemble of the disk inclination. So we really have to do better models to understand it. But the surprising thing is that the equivalent width is so high. When you look at the sample of local Seyfertz, then some of them have such a high equivalent width, but only 10%, and the rest don't show anything. And we believe that this is connected to the high metallicity. We need to include 3 times solar metallicity to explain this strong iron signal. And it looks like this is consistent with also optical measurements that quasars have quite high, I mean, supersolar metallicities. It looks like the quasars or the environments of quasars can actually produce very efficiently metals. And so it looks like the average background AGN has a relatively high metallicity. And the reason why this is not seen, I believe, in the local Seyfert galaxies is because they are at much lower than Eddington ratio. So they don't accrete very efficiently, and therefore also they don't produce stars very efficiently. Whereas the quasars they are in a very highly active environment, and they are producing metals stronger.
So, Gunther, that curve is anomaly. It's weighted towards what sort of luminosity? I mean, that's a luminosity weighted.
Yes. Yes.
What are the objects that are?
I think the about 10 to the 44 arcs per second.
Okay, so
yes. I mean, there is also this X-ray Baldwin effect, which is known from local objects that the CFETs have a larger equivalent width than the quasars. This is more in the middle somewhere. I mean, between CFETs and quasars.
I mean, so, if you were to take somebody's photo ionization model of a disk, so that the near gas would be at the higher ionization stage. Oh no, you already told me that I can't explain that with
ionization.
Anything but a very large.
Yes.
Yeah,
I think ionization is clearly playing a role when you come to determine the parameters, but it doesn't change the overall. Okay. So this is good news for the next X-ray telescope, because XeusCon-X that we are hoping for will have the power to get similar spectra of every individual object, and then we can really study them in great detail. Right? This is just a stacking analysis. I mean, what I say is, if we are fitting this profile with, if we force it to be a Schwarzschild black hole, then the inner and outer disk radius both fall at roughly 6 Schwarzschild radii. So I can in principle explain it as a Schwarzschild black hole, which just has a ring of emission right at the last stable orbit. But on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of discussion now that the last stable orbit is not really a strong boundary, that the actually matter can actually go through and so on. So there's a big question mark still about the theory. And also, there's one problem, as you see here, the error bars are actually, they look like they are overestimated, right? There's not, if you fit a line through here, then there's not a single data point which is lying outside the line. And I think this is part of the way we are adding the spectra. We are averaging the spectra after we divide the bright sources, we divide every source by its flux, and then we average more or less the shapes. And so the error bars are somehow transported in a conventional way. And I believe we can do better. The error bars are still overestimated. So if we get the error bars down into the real ones, then we probably get a statistical significant difference between Schwarzschild and Kerr black hole.
But this is averaged over many different objects.
Yes, 50 objects. It's averaged over 50 objects. And we also have to make models with many different inclination angles and things like that. So it's still work in progress, but the signal is there, and that's already exciting. Okay, now let me come to the luminosity function. As I said, to study the luminosity function, you need these deep fields, but you also need a large variety of wider, shallower fields. And so what we have now, we are concentrating this work to the type 1 AGN. So those are the unabsorbed sources. We know from the X-ray or from the optical that they are broad lines or unabsorbed. So we don't, for this work, we don't want to get into complications by different amounts of obscuring material along the line of sight. So we basically exclude the CFET2 population and only look at the CFET1 and AGN1. And then we also concentrate on the 0.5 to 2 keV band, which is the classical Rosat band. Also, Chandra and XMM are now going to 10 keV. But we have all these large Rosat surveys, and we want to make use of the large variety of sources. So this is only half of the coin. Principally, you have to do the same work, including the type 2s and the hard sources. I will do that. I will show that in the end. But this is now an exquisite sample of about 1,000 AGN, out of which 65 are unidentified. And it turns out, when you want to make very accurate statement, these unidentified sources are a pain in the neck. So you want to beat them as much down as possible. And for instance, if you compare the two deepest fields here, the Chandra Deep Field North, which is the deepest, and the Chandra Deep Field South, which is the second deepest, then they differ very much in their unidentified source fraction. We only have one source left in this sample, but there's about one-third of the sources unidentified, or one-fourth. in the Chandra Deep Field North. And the main reason is that there are no near-infrared deep imaging data in the north, so we are not so good in doing the photometric redshifts. And so for some of these studies, I'm excluding the Chandra Deep Field North, unfortunately. but there's still work to be done. So when I'm plotting all these samples in a diagram luminosity versus redshift, then each of these samples is tracing out its own correlation line. Each survey has a flux limit and therefore is a line like this. This is the ROSAT All-Sky survey. This is ROSAT Serendipity sources, then XMM sources, Chandra sources. And the nice thing is if you add all of them together, then you are filling this Hubble diagram almost completely. And that's very important because now you can, for instance, cut this at a certain redshift. You take a redshift slice, and then you can directly read off the luminosity function. Or you can actually cut it at a certain luminosity, and you can directly read off the density function, the function how density goes with redshift. And there's not very much modeling involved here. You can just look at the samples as they are. And this is the number counts, just to show how the different surveys are contributing to the number counts. This is a Euclidean behavior would be a horizontal line in this curve. So we are dividing by the Euclidean. You see it's almost Euclidean, although it's a bit flatter here. And then there's this big turnover. This is the total sample. And then when we only take the type 1 AGN, only the unabsorbed AGN, then you see that this is almost perfectly Euclidean here. And then it goes down rapidly. And the nice thing is, while in this band here, the AGN are only making about 1/10 of all objects. Most of the objects here are clusters, stars, BLAC objects. And down here, they only make about 1/3 of all objects. In this intermediate range, in ROSAT, they make 80% of all objects. So that's the reason why ROSAT is so important for the study of the luminosity function of the type 1 AGN. This is the luminosity function in different redshift shells. So 0.2, 0.4, 0.8, 1.6, 3.2, 4.8. And in green, I'm plotting the shape of the local luminosity function for all of these curves. And then you see that there is a clear change both in this direction. So in luminosity, there is some evolution in luminosity. That means these curves are shifting significantly to the right. But there is also a clear shift in density. So it's inconceivable to explain this only with luminosity evolution. We have luminosity and density evolution. And one of the models that has been propagated, this is just a mathematical description, is luminosity dependent density evolution. So at every luminosity, you basically calculate the density evolution and you plot that. But this is only a mathematical model. I mean, we want to have real models to compare that with. If you do the other way, if you are cutting the sources in luminosity and then plot their redshift distribution, then you are getting for the luminous objects. This is these are above 10 to the 45, 44 to 45, 43 to 44, and 42 to 43. So the quasar, those are more or less quasars, and those are Seyfert's in rough discrimination. Then the quasars are actually showing more or less the behavior that we all know. They have a very strong evolution from about a factor of 1,000 from the local universe out to redshift 1.5. And then they are staying flat. And then in the optical, they decline. In the X-rays, we still do not see a decline, but the error bars are so large that we cannot say about the decline in the quasar. But so this is more or less exactly, I will do a comparison with the optical quasars in a minute, what you expect for the quasars. When you look at the Seyfert's, then you see that the peak in redshift is actually going lower and lower. And also, you see that the evolution from redshift 0 to the peak is getting only a factor of 10 here instead of a factor of 1,000. And so there's a clear change in the evolutionary behavior of Seyfert's versus quasars. And in particular, this peak is significantly shifting to lower and lower redshifts.
Can you try and understand which ones you're calling Seyfert's and which?
Luminosity, yeah. So luminosity 4 to 10 to the 44, everything above we call quasars, everything below Cepheids. But this is just, too hinged somewhere what we know. But what I wanted to say is that the optical surveys are only limited to this part of the diagram. The optical surveys are not able to say something about this. So this so-called, what we call anti-hierarchical behavior, that massive objects come first and low-mass objects come later, this is new from the X-rays. That could not be seen with the optical behavior. And what we also now see with these beautiful samples that we have is for the first time a clear decline of the space density, at least in the Cepheid population. Here it is indicated, here it is not yet good enough. But so it's clear that the quasar or the AGN towards high redshift declines. So we see a kind of growth phase here. Just to mention these differences between the dashed curves and the solid curves. The solid curves are if we take all of our identified sources and calculate the space densities. The dashed curve is if we take all of our unidentified sources, and then we assume that they all have the redshift 4.5, or we assume they all have the redshift 3. So this is actually a very too conservative upper limit, because we are multiplying the unidentified sources here. But this gives the maximum allowed space density for including the unidentified sources. And I think this is where this work is so much better than anybody else, because if you do the same thing, for instance, for Barga or Ueda et al. Or so, all of their unidentified source fractions are up here. So they are not able to determine the decline, which we see here for the first time. Okay, now I come to the comparison between the soft and the hard band, because similar work has been done by Ueda et al. Based on 250 AGN, which are selected in the 2 to 10 kV band. And this is based on ASCA, HEO1, and Chandra data. And you see that to first order, we have colored the curves roughly the same. So this is 42 to 43. This is 41.5 to 43. So this is the white curve. 43 to 44.5, 43 to 44, and so on. You see that in general, they see the same behavior as far as they can cover. But for instance, when you compare the low luminosity curve, we are now getting constraints out to redshift 3. They stop at redshift 0.7. So the soft samples are much more sensitive than the hard samples. The reason is that even the Chandra telescopes, they have 10 times more effective area in the soft band than in the hard band. And so I think what has to be done, so far many people are using the Ueda et al. Luminosity function, and we are getting completely consistent results as far as there is the overlap. But what we still have to do is combine these samples to do a joint, constraint. So very similar behavior in the soft and the hard band, but we are just going deeper and are more complete. So for instance, they are also stopping at, the 44.5 to 48. So all of these three curves here, which we have, are collapsed into one curve here. So this is just because of the statistics. Fine. Let me say one other word, because what we are looking at so far is space density. So this is just a summary once more of what we find. And the space density is increasing dramatically, but it's also peaking at these low redshifts. That is the reason, when you look in the Chandra surveys, why the average redshift is 0.7, because we are finding these things. What you really want to look at is the luminosity density when it comes to black hole formation, because these objects produce 1,000 times more light and therefore also 1,000 times more black hole mass than these objects. So this curve here is multiplying each one by its luminosity. And then you see that the luminosity density, if you add up all of these curves, the Cepheids, those redshift 0.7 objects, don't make a very large fraction of the total black hole light. And indeed, the total black hole light is still dominated by quasar-type objects, by things at around 10 to the 44 or 10 to the 45, and at redshifts 2 to 3. So these standard Zoltan-type arguments, where you compare the background with the local quasar or black hole density, are still roughly correct, because the main thing that goes in there is the average redshift of the sources. But in reality, we now have much more detailed curves. Okay, an interesting thing that can be done, I talked about the Zoltan argument. You can now Using the X-ray luminosity function, you can estimate what is the black hole accreted mass function. And you can then compare that to the local black hole mass function in the that we see in the local galaxies. And for the first time, using the Ueda et al. Luminosity function, it is now consistent. You get consistent results. This is the accreted black hole mass function from the luminosity function. And this grayscale is the best estimate of, at least in this paper, of the local black hole mass function. And they fit very well together. If you assume an efficiency, you have to assume an efficiency, and the efficiency which they need is around 0.1 here. This is what we always have assumed, but now it really shows that there is a very nice match between what we see in the light and what we see in the mass locally. Such a high efficiency, in principle, you need a Kerr black hole to do that, because a Schwarzschild black hole gives you an efficiency of 0.05, roughly. And if you consider that we only see the light, but we now know that there's a lot of kinetic energy coming out of black holes as well, then I think this means that the average black hole should be spinning rapidly. And this would be consistent with what we see in the iron emission line. Okay, now let me come quickly to a comparison between the optical and the X-ray samples, because in particular, at high luminosity and high redshift, the optical samples are still much better than what we get with the X-rays. These are the optical quasar counts, the blue curves. This is from the 2DF survey based on 15,000 quasars. And this is from the Sloan and Schmidt-Schneider and Gunn survey. So this shows this clear decline at the high redshift. The nice thing, I mean, these two samples still can be arbitrarily normalized, because they are based on completely different selections. This is just the photometric pre-selection on point sources. This is partly emission line surveys and partly also photometric. And the nice thing in the X-rays is that we are getting information more or less with the same method over the whole band. So we can use what we have done here is use the X-ray space densities to renormalize the optical ones. And then you see that to first order, we are finding consistent results. In particular, if you know that the X-rays, I mean, this is only one luminosity, and as a function of luminosity, it's changing. So I would claim that so far we have now more or less consistent results between the X-rays and the optical. But it's very clear that we need many more high redshift quasars in the X-rays in order to get better constraints. And to get more quasars, we have to rely on wider surveys, because the quasars are so rare that we need much larger solid angles to cover that. And so there are two things that I want to quickly mention.
So what's the difference between the dotted arrow?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I didn't mention this. The dotted
all the indications quasar X-rays going down comes from the
That's right. Yes, actually, the dotted ones. This is the treatment that Martin Schmidt is doing. I mean, we have a paper where we have two different methods. One is Martin Schmidt's V over Vmax method, and the other one is a BIND estimate. And indeed, I mean, what the dotted also shows is that the error bar is getting very large here. And so those two, the yellow and the pink one, are consistent with each other. But here we have just put in the model from the optical. So Martin Schmidt more or less tests against whether the optical model is consistent with the X-ray model, whereas we are doing a model-free BIND estimate. Here you also see that the unidentified sources can, in principle, still play a significant role. Yes, sorry. The dotted line is if you take all the unidentified sources and put them at a redshift of 5, then we would still see no. And indeed, I think this data point at redshift 4, there is still no indication of a decline, where the optical is already declining, but the error bars are just too large. So.
In the previous transparency on this point, you had said that the highest luminosity bin didn't show a decline, unlike the optical. I'm just trying to understand why this.
Yes, this is actually not the highest. This is the second highest. When we go back here, that's this one. And in the highest, it's getting even worse because the error bars are even larger. So this is the one which, yeah, some decline is indicated, but is only within one sigma. So my main message is we need more data at wider surveys. And that's the reason why we go in two fields. We are now trying to widen the area. One is this extended Chandra Deep Field South. So what is covered so far is the Chandra Deep Field South proper. With Neil Brandt, we now have four pointings that cover the whole, this whole field has been covered with HST. And indeed, two of them, all four have been taken, but two of them have been analyzed. And the rest, we just got the data a week ago or so. So this is now completed, and we are now trying to get the optical spectroscopy. And the area is already four times larger than what we have here. But the real nice field is this Cosmos field, which is a big international collaboration to cover one field in the sky in many different wavelengths. This is 2 square degrees in total, 1.5 degrees on the side. And that has been covered almost completely with HST ACS images. So what you see here is the mosaic of the HST image. And we have been awarded 1.4 megaseconds with XMM Newton to cover this whole field in the X-rays. So far, we have 10 pointings covered, but in the meantime, there are a few more. So within a year or so, we will have the whole thing covered. Spectroscopy is done in the VLT. So in a year from now, we hope to get better statistics on quasars. And then finally, the ultimate quasar survey would be Duo. This is what we are still hoping for. This is in the current SMEX competition. 5 missions have been studied for a phase A study. And the decision which of those 5 missions should go ahead has already been taken, but not announced. So we are holding our breath that we get this new mission. This mission is similar to the Abrixas mission, which we have already built once, which was supposed to do an all-sky survey. It is using the same telescopes, but this time we want to cover the Sloan area, just the Sloan Digital Sky area, and then also another deeper area in the south. And what the main aim is the dark energy. I'm not able to talk about that right now, but we are getting dark energy constraints which are similar to SNAP and Planck in the next generation of dark energy missions. But apart from the 10,000 clusters which Duo will detect, we also detect about 170,000 quasars. And so if we get really Duo, then we will detect basically the same number of high redshift quasars or even more than all the quasars which we know so far from Sloan to DF and so on. And so that will really be the very nice body of. In particular, we are expecting about 10 at redshifts above 6. So it's similar to what we know.
What's the angular resolution?
Angular resolution is about 20 arc seconds. And so we can just barely discriminate a redshift 1 clusters from point sources, but it's all done in a statistical fashion. We can solve for all of the incompletenesses and so on. So I think it's similar. The angular resolution is similar to the ROSAT PSPC, and ROSAT PSPC could detect high redshift clusters very nicely, and so that's what we're aiming. And the energy range is 0.1 to 15 kV roughly. So it's a CCD. So we would get a large sky survey with a CCD and a similar, 10 times deeper than ROSAT in the north and 100 times deeper than ROSAT in the south. So it's really a very powerful survey.
Assuming it is funded, when is it
started? 2007 or 2008 would be the launch date, and then it should run for 2 years. So in a few years, it's not so long. The nice thing is that we have already developed the mirrors are already more or less built once. The detectors, we have a new detector developed on the basis of the XMM Newton detector, but we already have flight chips basically for the camera. So it is, we are just ready to go.
Is it basically looking for the baryon oscillations in the power
spectrum? No, it's looking for N of C's. That means number of clusters as a function of redshift.
Oh,
and it's also looking for the power spectrum constraints. So we are joining power spectrum and NOC. And with 10,000 clusters, we can get, if you are asking, this is just the plot of dark energy versus dark matter. We are getting about, this is a 2 sigma contour, we're getting about 0.05 or so accuracy in W. So this is comparable to what SNAP and others are expecting. Okay, now let me, in the last few minutes, do I still have 5 minutes or give you my idea or my scenarios, why, I mean, what could be behind this anti-hierarchical evolution. I mean, that is now coming to the theme of the workshop, namely, what is the relation between that and the gas in the galaxies. So the first thing I wanted to say is, if we take these space density curves and we plot the predictions from the most recent semi-analytical models, for instance, Wyeth and Loeb, or also Menci et al., they fail miserably. Wyeth and Loeb, for instance, here, they still predict the high luminosity quasars to come later than the low luminosity sources. So they still predict an hierarchical behavior. So here you have the peak at redshift, say, 4. And for the most luminous quasars, you have the peak at redshift 2, whereas we find the something else. Menci et al. Have been tuned to the already known X-ray results from Fiore et al., but they still fail. So there is some ingredient in these models missing that I believe is significant. And I believe it is something to do with high luminosity sources being able to accrete matter much more efficiently than low luminosity sources. And I wanted to show this to you. Let me just quickly go through the basis. The first star in the universe is very likely producing the first black hole. This is from Tom Abel's Discovery Channel simulation. That is a simulation of the first basically compact object, which has roughly 1 million solar masses, and then he's zooming into that, and then we are seeing one shell after another, a factor of 10 density increase, and in the end, he's coming to some object which is roughly. It starts with one solar mass when it starts to shine, I mean, to have nuclear radiation. But during the 3 million years where it is shining, about 300 solar masses or so are accumulating on that star. And then it is a high mass star which is exploding in a supernova explosion, and then hopefully is leaving a black hole. And maybe also hopefully it is producing a gamma ray burst. because we now know that black hole formation and gamma ray bursts are connected to each other. So the idea is that very early in the universe, redshift 20 or so, you have a gamma ray burst which is producing the first black hole, and that kind of mini black hole in the end is then the seed of what later turns into a quasar. Now when you take that mini black hole at redshift 20, I mean, mini black hole means 10 solar mass black hole or something like that, at redshift 20, and you would be able to feed it continuously at the Eddington limit. This is from a paper by Archibald et al. I forgot to, that was in the previous slide. Then it takes about 500 million years until you are at 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8 solar masses or so, or 10 to the 9 solar masses, and that is roughly redshift 6.5. If this is redshift 20, then that corresponds roughly to the known quasars. And somewhere on the way here, this thing, for instance, at a redshift of 10, has 10 to the 4 solar masses. And I mean, these mini quasars, as Piero also is studying, may very well have a role in the ionization of the universe and so on. And so one of our goals in the future is to try to push this to a redshift 10, to try to find objects at 10 to the 4 solar masses at a redshift of 10. And this XUS-CON-X merger, if it happens, with a 10 square meter optics, would in principle be just sensitive to detect these 10 to the 4 solar masses at a redshift of 10. Yes?
How much do these conclusions depend on the cosmological model? Such as how sensitive is it to the dark energy?
Yeah, I mean, the difference in time between redshift 20 and redshift 6 is significantly dependent on lambda. So this is assuming a lambda CDH model. If lambda is 0, then the universe has much less time to form these things. So this is more or less consistent with lambda.
Well,
You mean, assuming it's flat?
Yes.
Depends on omega.
Yeah, that's right. No, if it's flat, yeah. If omega would be 1, then we wouldn't have enough time to produce these things. Okay, now the big puzzle is, this is under the assumption that the black hole is continuously fed at the Eddington rate of over 500 million years. And this is a big puzzle, because you have to basically take a whole galaxy and swallow it, I mean, squeeze it down to 1 parsec. And the big problem is to get from 1 kiloparsec to 1 parsec. This is still an unsolved problem, because all of this matter has angular momentum, and it's just impossible to get it down in a normal way. I think this is also the main reason why our galactic center right now is so under-luminous. We know that there are stars, and these stars have winds. So there should be plenty of matter, but the matter just doesn't get down. And I think one of the reasons is because the winds have angular momentum, and so they just don't get down. And so somehow nature must have found a way to overcome this problem. And I think the way that nature has found is through major mergers, of galaxies. Because what happens when two galaxies are merging, and you need two gas-rich galaxies, so galaxies that have a lot of gas, you know, the stars are falling through each other without noticing very much, and they are just redistributed. But these two gas disks collide with each other, and then you are producing a very thick and dense gas region. And the work that we are doing together with Duschl and Strittmatter and others shows that is the condition where all of a sudden the whole galaxy has a viscosity of more or less an accretion disk, and then you can have matter accreting very efficiently down to the black hole. So you need major mergers to supply the gas. And what we found here is, this is the Chandra image of one of these merging galaxies, NGC 6240. That already before the two black holes are merging, there are actually very luminous quasar-type X-ray sources. So we found two black holes in the center of this galaxy. Each of them has quasar-type luminosity. Also, it's completely obscured, so you only see it in the X-rays. But when we calculate the luminosity, they have already about 10 to the 8 solar masses or so, both black holes. And so that is when you similar, this is one of these animations or simulations, two galaxies going through each other. But these are the stars now and not the gas. Now we are zooming into the center, and these two black holes are now running around in this thick accretion disk, and they both accrete very efficiently. This process takes about 100 million years or so, and over these 100 million years they can accrete, 10 to the... It's depending from where you start, but they could accrete up to 10 to the 8 solar masses, maybe. And so then you wait 100 million years, and then they merge. And after the merger, I mean, they produce gravitational radiation. But then the single black hole is still accreting from the gas which is there.
In the observed case that you find, is there any way to say if those black holes fit the mass sigma?
No. So far not, because this is such a turbulent situation that there is no real, I mean, it's very hard to estimate the stellar velocity profiles and things like that. Now, this was just pure fantasy, but what I want to show you, I mean, first, there are now several other binary black holes claimed. There was one other one in X-rays found. There is the claim that some of the SCUBA sources are actually binary black holes. And I believe that this could be the major accretion mode in quasars, in normal quasars. I mean, we have quarreled there with Piero about that. But if this picture is correct, then basically merging is needed to supply the gas. And then it's very likely that both black holes are active. So a fraction of the normal quasars should have binary black holes. Yeah, but the problem is that there is all this gas and dust around. So I think there are a kind of there are evolutionary scenarios where in the pre-merger phase it is probably a lot of obscured emission. So you would have to look at merging galaxies in the X-rays, and then the quasar, as we'll see in a minute, is able to blow out, it's clean out its environment, and then it starts to shine bright. So what I wanted to say. Yes. I mean, this The LISA. The LISA people were very happy when we announced this result, because this was the first time that there was really some object where it was proven that these objects are gravitational bound and they will actually collide with each other. But these kinds of events are the ones that LISA really will see. Actually, they will be more sensitive to non-equal mass mergers, where a smaller black hole is coming into a larger black hole. Anyhow, what I wanted to say that this is pure fantasy so far, but very recently I have got permission to show this by Tiziana Di Matteo, Volker Springl, Lars Hörnqvist. I was shocked by this movie. This is now a simulation that they did, which shows only the gas, that they have ignored the stars. So you have two gas-rich galaxies which are coming together, and sorry. Come on, once more. Okay, and here is the position of the black hole at that moment. So you see a spiral arms forming, and then for the first time the two galaxies are only touching each other. The gas is compressed here in this region, but they are still flying apart from each other. Then you get these tidal tails, and then the movement is broken, and here you form this bar. You form a bar. You have gas flowing between the two galaxies. Then they approach each other again, and now something dramatic happens. You see that now winds are blowing out. So now the black holes are starting to be fed dramatically, and they basically blow out the whole gas in the galaxy. They have not yet merged, so they are accreting already very efficiently. Now, I think they just flew apart from each other. Now they really merge, and when they merge, then the whole gas of the galaxy is basically blown out in that simulation. And so, I mean, the temperature is actually, the color gives you the temperature, so blue is low temperature and yellow is high temperature. So in the end, you are just ending up with some high temperature gas, apart from the stars.
What did they assume for the output from the
radio? Yes, I think they did. And so, I mean, what they're missing is the jet and the directedness and so on. But the energy, I think they just took the same energy which is accreted, also one-to-one is also blown out, like in some of these ADIOS solutions. Now, the nice thing is when you plot the star formation rate and the black hole luminosity and then the black hole mass accreted, they did this for two cases, one without the two black holes and one with the two black holes. And basically the main effect of the two black holes is that they are blowing away the gas in the merged galaxy. So they basically quench the star formation rate. So in the end, there is no more gas and therefore is no more stars. And so what they claim is that this is the main reason for the M sigma relation, that because the black hole basically controls how many stars are allowed to form in the galaxy, and the mass of the black hole is more or less dependent on the mass of the dark matter potential below. So during this merger event here, the black holes would grow here to 10 to the 8 solar masses each or something like that. But then they can also start with other galaxies where they get to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So I think this is, and the quasar phase itself, Piero, quasar phase itself is only this very short moment in time, because we were quarreling that the quasar, we know that the quasar QT cycle is very short compared to emerging timescale of a galaxy. But this is really only happening in the very last moment when the merger happens itself. But this story tells us that already way before the two black holes are growing and they are accreting. So I think this gives one, I think we are running out of time. Two more viewers, one more. This gives at least one explanation why it is possible to feed a black hole efficiently. Now this is work that Andy Burkert and others have done. This shows the merger rate as a function of redshift for different mergers. This is 1-to-1 mergers, 1-to-2 mergers, up to 9-to-1 mergers. Because we were originally thinking that maybe the major mergers are doing the quasars and the minor mergers are doing the Seyfert galaxies. But from this plot, we find that the minor mergers, the 9-to-1 mergers, more or less appear at the same redshift as the 1-to-1 mergers. And so I think what is missing in this whole game is now I believe that the quasars actually, because they have this efficient accretion mode, they more or less follow exactly the merger rate. But then when you have low ratio mergers, then what you don't get is this compression of the accretion disk, and therefore the matter is not accreting so efficiently. And therefore, Seyfert galaxies have to build up their mass much slower. So the Seyfert galaxies are the ones which are not following the merger rate, whereas the quasars follow the merger rate in this case. So let me finish here. I ignore the tidal capture events, and let me just summarize. The X-ray background has practically been resolved below 2 keV, but above 2 keV, there is still a lot of work to do. We have found type 2 quasars, but the type 2 fraction decreases with luminosity. The background AGN have a strong relativistic iron line. And then comes this luminosity function argument that the Seyferts are peaking much later than the quasars. And this anti-hierarchical evolution model is so far not predicted by most of the semi-analytical models. And I believe you need to put in an additional ingredient, namely a kind of switch. The switch is 1 if the masses are very, if there's a gas-rich merger, and the switch is less than 1 if you have a non-gas-rich merger. So the role of accretion through mergers is the most critical point there. Thank you very much.